Here at home, we Americans are still talking about the weather. The January springtime has vanished from the east. Now the weatherman is talking about a big snowstorm that might hit New York tomorrow. And in Washington, President Truman walked 8 blocks in 21-degree temperature to go to church. But after the service, he went back to Blair House in his car. Apparently, there's no improvement in the real suffering in the western states. Today, the Army says, we just don't have enough planes to feed the starving cattle by air. And so the Army announces, attention is now concentrated on saving human life. But in the midst of the terrible cold wave in Iowa, a shopkeeper sold 10 straw hats and was pretty upset about it until he found out the straw hats are for a stunt put on by the Junior Chamber of Commerce. And now for Pillsbury, here is Arthur Gary.
Thank you, Bob Trout. What's a man's idea of the perfect dessert for a perfect meal? Why, it's homemade apple pie and cheese, of course. Fresh-baked, fragrant apple pie made with Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Yes, because you can make such light, tender, flaky crust with Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Even if you've never baked before, you can be sure of success when you use America's largest-selling pie crust mix, Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix. Remember, too, every package of Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix contains 9 full ounces. Plenty of fixings for a big two-crust pie. Get a package or two soon and serve your own delicious homemade apple pie and cheese. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
WMAQ and WMAQ-FM, NBC in Chicago. Ozzy will become a bus driver, temporarily at least, on the Ozzy and Harriet Show at 5:30 today. Be sure to listen. And then stay tuned for another of Horace Heidt's programs at 6 o'clock. And Fred Allen will take his weekly stroll down Main Street at 7, WMAQ.
Today, the real humorist is fast disappearing. Yes, sir, the average radio comedian is a mouth that speaks the thoughts of others' brains. Machine-age humor, like the automobile, is turned out on the assembly line.
Living 1949, brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, convinced that a sense of humor is essential to making sense of our times, holds up its radio mirror today to reflect
the state of American humor.
And here with the customary smile on his face, a little broader than usual, is Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. It was Carlyle, our researchers tell us, who once said,
how much lies in laughter, the cipher key wherewith we decipher the whole man.
Yes, and Carlyle might well have added, the cipher key, too, to unraveling the character of whole generations. What men laugh at and why? Someday someone will reflect the history of mankind through these. For each generation makes its own humor, and by its humor as well as by its bones and its battles shall we know it. And so in the midst of living 1949, we examine the state of the nation by examining the state of American humor. To this end, we've sought to tickle our curiosity with the following questions.
What exactly is humor? For instance, what makes people laugh?
Does humor have a history?
What does humor do for us?
How would you rate our humor today? And what about humor tomorrow?
Questions are easily come by. Digging up the answers isn't so easy, so we had to dig up an authority. You can put away the shovel, boys. Here he is, Fred Allen.
Well, thank you, Ben Grauer, and good afternoon, students of laughter. Gosh, I wish this was night school, Ben. This is a little too early in the day for me to scintillate. Am I using the right word there?
Scintillate? Very good, Fred.
You approve of it, eh? I only have it on approval for the afternoon. You know, comedians and night watchmen do their best work after the sun goes down. But since Brother Grauer has opened the forum, I shall do my best, naturally, to carry on. May I have the first question, please?
Oh, well, Mr. Allen, what exactly is humor? For instance, what makes people laugh?
Oh, an excellent question. What makes people laugh? So many times my sponsor has asked that question. Down through the ages, there have been many answers to that question. What makes people laugh? Sigmund Freud once said,
strictly speaking, we do not know what we are laughing about.
Say, Freud not only has a dialect, he seems to be a trifle confused along with it. Well, let's try one of the most amusing, amusing Americans that ever lived, Mark Twain.
The secret source of humor itself is not joy, but sorrow.
Mark's a little indefinite, too. Now, let's see. Before I was born, surely someone must have analyzed humor.
Easy does it, Sonny.
Ah, and you, sir, you are...
Josh Billings, my friend. I was telling the jokes when they was really new on Living 1849.
Ah, yes, Mr. Billings. You're one of the foremost characters in American humor. Can you help us with our question? What exactly is humor?
Why, humor is wit with a rooster's tail feather stuck in its cap. It produces laughter, which, anatomically speaking, is the sensation of feeling good all over and showing it principally in one spot.
Well, thank you, Josh Billings. That answers the $64 question. Stand by for Gabriel and the giant jackpot. And so there you have it, America. Humor is that factor in man's makeup that produces laughter and makes him feel good all over. Of course, there is no set rule as to what makes your lips turn up at the corners. That, of course, depends on what you have between your ears. But the unexpected in any situation, the incongruous, that is the basis of humor. Now, let me see. There was another part to the question.
Yes, Mr. Allen. What does humor do for us?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. What does humor do for us? And for the answer to that one, we begin where most people usually end, with this gentleman here, bearing the couch and the goatee, the psychiatrist.
People laugh to protect themselves by pretending to take lightly those things which affect them most seriously.
I see. Say, why don't you lie down on your couch and elaborate?
Thank you. I don't mind if I do.
Good. Now, doctor, if you're quite comfortable there, what does humor do for us?
In a day when high-pressure living is turning out numberless neurotics, laughter and humor serve as safety valves against the tyranny of the world and the problems of daily living.
Well, thank you, Doctor. You can pick up your couch and scram now.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Thank you.
Well, there is more truth in that, America, than psychology. Indeed, as our recent acquaintance, Josh Billings, once said...
If a man can't laugh, there's some mistake made in putting him together. And if he won't laugh, he wants as much keeping away from as a bear trap when it's set.
Well, this, according to Josh, is what humor does for us. It's a relief, a safety valve. It gets things out of our systems. And why should I bother to dig up Josh Billings just to argue about that? Which brings us to our third question.
Mr. Allen, does humor, like more respectable subjects, have a history?
There will be a brief pause here, not for station identification, but while I resent the implication that my business is not respectable. Now, as for the question I hasten to answer, Dame Humor has a past. That's possibly why she's referred to as a dame. I can close my eyes now and hear the first joke that was ever cracked. The scene, somewhere around a few eons after the Ice Age. I see the forest primeval, prehistoric animals, looking like refugees from some museum with their flesh on. And finally, I see a caveman, possibly an ancestor of Jack Benny's. He's carrying the jawbone of a relative. He's meeting along one of nature's byways a second caveman. Says the first caveman to the second caveman...
Say, who that lady I see you with last night?
Answers the second caveman.
That was no lady. That was wife.
Whether or not this is truly the Adam Eve of all jokes has been subject to some dispute in the more learned circles which I seldom frequent. Personally, I can think of no other joke that could have preceded it. But once man got the idea, once he saw how laughter made him feel good all over, like breathing, he made a habit of it, and he never afterwards gave it up. By the time the pilgrims landed at Plymouth, men and women through bitter experience had learned to laugh at almost anything. The wit of the New England Yankee is chiseled imperishably in stone, in gravestone.
Beneath
This silent stone is laid a noisy, antiquated maid, who from her cradle talked till death, and ne'er before was out of breath.
It was Ben Franklin, in between tying keys to kite strings, who brought this kind of humor to its zenith, when the population of Boston was only 1,200 people and every man was a self-appointed censor. Franklin invented the first American fool character, Poor Richard with his almanac, and out of the mouth of this babe in the history of American humor came such bone-dry comments as,
"Keep your eyes wide open before marriage and half shut afterwards."
Thus off to a happy start, Americans went right on laughing into the 1800s. And like the people, the humor became independent, assertive, attacking pretensions both high and low. But when the nation began to grow and stretch its muscles westward, with the blossoming of new cities, blossomed a new humor, the humor of the frontiersman, boundless like the nation itself.
Yes, sir, it's a tall country. Why, in California, the fogs are so thick, the ships often sail right across them till they hit the Sierra Nevada mountains. Why, they even nail shingles to the fog, and it gets so cold at night, your shadow freezes on the wall, and they have to use blow torches to thaw it out.
You see, blow torches. Today's smudge pots. A gag then, it's a gag now. California weather. So taking Davy Crockett and Paul Bunyan in stride, and with Paul it's quite a stride, by 1850 American humor was out of the woods and into the minstrel halls.
Ham, listen here.
Yeah?
Can you tell me which is fastest, heat or cold?
No, Julius. Which is the fastest?
Why, heat.
Heat? How so?
Because anybody can catch cold.
It was a leisurely age of leisurely humor, uncorrupted by Hooper ratings, and one which, if the good Lord had consulted me, I certainly would have been very happy to match wits in. Besides our late friend Josh Billings, one of the prime favorites of those days was Charles Brown, better known as Artemus Ward. Artemus once remarked,
"Most of the girls in Utah marry young. Brigham Young."
Of Ward and Billings, Abe Lincoln once confessed,
"For the genius to write these things, I would gladly give up my office."
Say, you know, that reminds me, I have yet to hear Truman, Harry S., say that about me. But let's not be wistful. Comes now Mark Twain. Mark Twain, who said he never saw his father smile, was truly a giant in American humor. With the kind of time on his hands that I have never known since I discovered radio, Mark casually spun his fun, much of which, thank heaven, is not suitable for radio. Mark marked a shift in American humor from the fool way of saying things to the wise way, and he it was who glorified a great American characteristic, the ability to poke fun at ourselves. When Mark was asked to celebrate the landing of the Pilgrims, he replied,
"Celebrate their landing? What was remarkable about that, I'd like to know. Why, those Pilgrims have been at sea 3 or 4 months. If they hadn't landed, there'd be some reason for celebrating the fact."
Twain was a natural. He didn't work at being funny. He just naturally was funny. With progress, laugh here, folks, the leisure of the times that marked the humor of Twain went down the drain. By the turn of the century, we're entering the 20th century, just in case you've become lost as we've come along the way, the big city industrialized populace turned to the faster moving humor of my late habitat, vaudeville.
Say, Joe, how can you stop a dead fish from smelling?
I don't know, Harry. How can you keep a dead fish from smelling?
Cut off its nose.
Like life, the pace of humor was stepped up. Everybody began to work at being funny, and the long, dragged-out humorous story shrunk to the short, snappy gag. The First World War came and went, leaving a backwash of so-called college humor, very vodeo-do. throughout these post-war years, new names came to the fore.
W.C. Fields, Rube Goldberg, Irvin S. Cobb, Bugs Baer, to name a few. And Ogden Nash, whose verse typified a smart-aleck quality of the era.
Many an infant that screams like a calliope could be soothed by a little attention to his diapy.
Dorothy Parker, Ring Lardner, and, of course, Robert Benchley, who wrote a book called
From Bed to Worse, or Comforting Thoughts About the Bison.
Actors, cartoonists, writers of nonsense for nonsense sake. But the man who truly commanded the grins of the nation, strangely enough using the old ways, was a drawling, gum-chewing guy from Claremore, Oklahoma.
Americans are getting just like Ford cars. They have all the same parts, same upholstery, and make exactly the same noises.
Will Rogers. Will Rogers, who when introduced at the White House to...
Mr. Coolidge, may I present Will Rogers?
Pardon me, I didn't get your name.
When Will met his unfortunate death, the golden age of the jester had just arrived. The talking picture was here to stay, and radio. Radio with the unseen, with the audience removed from the sight, identifying its unseen comedians with...
You nasty man!
Amos, as regusted.
Was you there, Charlie?
And so we reach the present, characterized in the words of Donald Ogden Stewart.
The age of newer nonsense, larger lunacy, higher goofyism, and humor gone nuts.
Well, Ben, I guess that about does it. I left out one line. I'll go back and read it if you want to.
Wasn't that about Will Rogers?
You said the President of the United States, and then Will should have spoken. But Will was in a hurry to get away again.
Well, Fred, we really thank you for presiding at the peephole while we rattle the skeletons in the closet of American humor. But tell us, Fred, now that you've brought us up to modern times, what about the answer to our next question, namely...
Mr. Allen, how would you rate our humor today? What does it reveal about us?
Well, go ahead, my guard's down. Why don't you interview me?
Oh, no, you're the narrator on today's program.
But I'm also the authority, don't forget, Ben.
Well, I guess there's only one way out, then. On the subject of present-day humor...
Yes?
Fred Allen interviews Fred Allen.
Well, I guess this proves it. If you stay in radio long enough, you'll end up talking to yourself.
Tell me, Mr. Allen.
Yes, Fred.
How would you characterize the humor of today?
The humor of today is like the times. Mechanized, urbanized, produced in such quantity, it's downright chaotic.
Why is that, Mr. Allen?
Well, look at the various demands put upon humor today. Humor for magazines, books, movies, plays, newspapers, radio.
Did you say radio, Mr. Allen?
Radio? Yes, I did say radio, sir. Radio is exactly where humor has reached its lowest ebb.
My word. And you would say, Mr. Allen?
I would say that while so-called radio humor flows unceasingly, it has lost all spontaneity. The king of the airwaves, the comedian, is rarely more than a mouthpiece for his writers. Now, witness one Jack Benny, who once confronted me with, "You wouldn't talk to me like that if I had my gag writers here."
You don't say.
Yes, I did say. But it didn't sound like Benny, but I did say. Yes, too many comedians... too many comedians survive on the brains of other people. Radio's so-called wit tends to be the product of tired gag writers and hectic gag sessions.
Well, is that bad, Mr. Allen?
Bad, Fred? Don't you ever listen to the radio?
But whose fault is it, Mr. Allen?
Well, it's nobody's fault. Radio comedians are victims of the times. Radio as a medium demands more so-called humorous material than there are creative minds to supply it.
Tell me, is it a hard life, Mr. Allen?
Is it a hard life? Is it a hard life? Have you ever thought what a radio comedian goes through in a week?
Monday,
from the moment my alarm clock rings, I begin to hear those inner voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I pull the covers up over my head. I stuff my fingers into my ears, but it's no use. The voices are always there, haunting me.
You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I jump out of bed. I flex my legs. I begin another week on the treadmill of radio.
Tuesday.
By Tuesday, I'm starting to get nervous. I reassure myself and sneak a peek at a fan letter about my last program. The fan letter reads,
"Do you smell?"
And back come the voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I haul out the jokes I've been stuffing into my pockets. Notes for jokes written on subways, in movies, on lonely walks, in the midst of nightmares. I take one horrible look and send for my usual breakfast. Say, Portland, poach two aspirin on toast.
Wednesday.
Wednesday again, and those voices greet me.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
But I defy them, because Wednesday is when I meet with my writers. My writers will save me. I know they'll save me.
Well, morning, Mr. Allen.
Morning, Mr. Allen.
Morning, Mr. Allen.
Well, boys, we need plenty of jokes for Sunday.
I got one, Mr. Allen.
Yes, Bob.
How's this? Listen, who was that ladle I saw you with last night? That was no ladle. That was my wife.
Hey, that's pretty good. I like that very much. I like that very much.
Yeah. Here we are back with the cavemen. With these radio writers, I must seek to replace the ledger of Mark Twain. Louder grow the voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be
funny
on Sunday.
No, 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 no. Thursday, we've got one joke. We need 75 more jokes to fill the script. Once again, I turn hopefully when one of my writers says...
Then you meet a guy on the street, see?
Yeah, yeah.
And he says to you, "Have you seen my dog?"
My dog.
And you say, "You mean the dog that limps with the black hair, long floppy ears, leather collar, and the spot between his eyes?" He says, "Yes." And you say, "No, I haven't seen him."
Wait a minute, Sam.
What's
look,
the matter?
I can't tell that gag. That gag goes back to Voltaire.
Who's Voltaire? I stole that one from Bob Hope.
Friday.
Friday, we really get into mass production humor. After the first rehearsal, the cry goes up for gags. Gags. We need more gags, man. Gags about...
babies, barbers, beauty, boats.
Drips, droops, dopes, dames.
To add to this bedlam, there are always those voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny.
Saturday.
Saturday is baked beans, more rehearsal and cutting, and of course...
You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I know.
Sunday.
You better be funny.
I'm ready.
Ladies and gentlemen, we give you the funniest man in America, Fred Allen.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight I start my program with a little song entitled, "When They Find Out About Phenobarbital in Tennessee, It'll Be Sleepy Time Down South."
Well, I guess the business of being funny today just ain't funny, Fred.
Well, that's just about it, Brother Grauer. Radio humor has become a serious, mass-produced enterprise, demanding material to fill 18 hours a day, and in the process, leaving its exhausted perpetrators, writers and actors both, mark you, with naught but blank expressions and trembling hands.
Fred, you've told us what humor is. Things are tough all over. You've told us what humor is, what
all
it does
me.
For us, something of its history, how you rate it today, and what it reveals about us, that is, how it reflects the fast tempo of modern life.
Yes.
Now, what about the future, Fred? You think, will things get any better? For instance,
will we laugh more tomorrow?
Well, the only way I can answer that question is to ask another question. Will we slow down tomorrow? Now, all humor, in my opinion, should be created and disseminated in an atmosphere of relaxation. There should be time to think humor, time to tell humor, and to enjoy humor. Maybe with men working fewer hours in the day and finding more leisure, the quality of our humor will improve. But I have my doubts. And certainly, radio works against all of this.
Well, you see little hope, then, for humor in radio? Huh?
Well, where there's life, of course, there's always hope, then. But the present-day trend, to me, it seems to be in the wrong direction. Now, look, I never thought that I would live to see the day when I'd have to compete with a washing machine and $300,000. Iceboxes are replacing actors and musicians. The idea is, of course, if you can't entertain people, give them something. Now, if that isn't a sorry commentary on contemporary entertainment, then I don't know a sorry commentary when I see one. And well, I have seen some sorry commentaries. I'm an authority on sorry commentaries, as a matter of fact.
Fred, but look, there's a new thought about what about television?
Well, television, I'm afraid, is going to make it worse, Ben. In the beginning, as you know, television drove people out of the saloons into their homes. But now people have sets in their homes. Television is driving them out of their homes back into the saloons.
Oh, no, wait a minute. But as a new source of humor, Fred?
Oh, new source of humor. So far, it's nothing but a throwback, reviving the vaudeville approach to everything, from mugging to juggling. But who can tell, Ben? Television is doing such great things in drama. Who knows? It may find the answer to what is lacking in American humor today.
Well, that brings us, Fred, to the last question of all. So what?
So what? Well, if you've summed up, so shall I. We can take hope from the fact that regardless of what radio and television are doing to it, humor will never die. Laughter is the privilege of the free, the solace of the oppressed. For my money, one of the most encouraging things about the United Nations is the fact that its members can joke about it. For instance...
Do you know why the designer of our permanent UN headquarters has designed special corridors?
Mais non, monsieur. Pourquoi?
It is for nations that want to... bypass issues.
I seem to remember those boys from the Chateau Martin wine program. Yes, maybe if we can find a common bond in humor to stop the fussing, fighting, and feuding in the world, we might actually laugh our way into peace. In the final analysis, laughter is the universal language of mankind, and a little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men.
A thousand thanks, Fred Allen. Living 1949 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC special program staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Lou Haslam writes the scripts. Music is conducted by Milton Katims. This program is directed by Jack Cuney. Next week, a drama document on the Marshall Plan, Operation Cooperation.
Robert Montgomery stars in Mr. and Mrs. Smith tonight on NBC.
WMAQ and WMAQ-FM, NBC in Chicago.